Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning about a subject that has been on my mind for several years. I title this talk, in keeping with the church's alliterative tradition, Conscience, Country, and Christianity. Christ tells us in Matthew 10:16, "Here I am sending you out like sheep with wolves all around you. So be wise as serpents and yet as harmless as doves. But be on your guard against men." Christ calls us to be in the world and not in isolated, protective Christian bubbles. But we need to be wise. So today's talk will be about our world, how we got to this point, and more importantly, what's the application for Christians today. Hopefully, we will cover a number of disciplines, including history, philosophy, international politics, travel, and even some current events. We will be taking a 30,000-foot overview of some of these topics, but I think that you will find they all come together for some thought-provoking Christian realities. My hope is that you will see the world in a broader perspective, and that our younger members especially will be inspired to adopt some lifelong purposes and challenges as part of their Christian walk. So our story begins in Poppy, Italy in 2016. On our way back from Israel, we spent a week with Beth's relatives in Arezzo, Italy, near Florence. Our cousins played tour guides the entire week, and we were privileged to see many beautiful parts of Tuscany. One day, we visited Poppy, a small village in this beautiful valley. The purpose of our visit was to see this old castle. In this castle was a display honoring a man I had never heard of before. His name was Tommaso Crudelli. Crudelli was born in 1702. He received his law degree in Pisa in 1726. 6 years later, he joined the newly established Masonic Lodge in Florence and was arrested by the Roman Catholic Inquisition. Imprisoned for 16 months, he suffered torture in a cell in total darkness, without any hygiene and with regular and cruel interrogations. The Inquisition was trying to get his confession of the names of his Masonic Lodge brothers without success. In April 1741, Crudelli was released from prison and sentenced to house arrest in Poppy. He lived another 4 years, but due to his imprisonment, he died shortly thereafter. But during that time, he dictated a long report, a report of inhumane treatment while being true to his conscience, and ultimately led to the closure of the Inquisition in Florence. In 1745, he died of the after effects of his imprisonment and was buried in a common grave. So as a public librarian, I always was interested in sustaining our citizens' rights of conscience as articulated in the First Amendment to our Constitution. To be perfectly honest, I was concerned that my Christian beliefs were being publicly subordinated or even silenced, and I wanted to protect those beliefs as well as everyone else's. But I had never investigated the history and evolution of the freedom of conscience. So that's what we're going to do today. So what is conscience? Unger's Bible Dictionary defines it this way: the awareness that a proposed act is or is not conformable to one's ideal of right and manifesting itself in the feeling of obligation or duty. Or the way I state it is standing up for your convictions in public or when pressured. So obviously this applies to religious beliefs because, as Judge Michael McConnell, a constitutional law expert and senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, has stated, religion is a special phenomenon, in part because it plays such a wide variety of roles in human life. It is an institution, but it's more than that. It's an ideology or worldview, but it's more than that. It is a set of personal loyalties and locus of community akin to family ties, as most folks in this room will attest, but it's also more than that. It is an aspect of identity, but it's more than that. It provides questions of ultimate reality, and it offers connections to the transcendent, but it's more than that. Religion cannot be reduced to a subset of any larger category. So living and being true to the Christian conscience is what we will talk about today. As stated before, we're going to be taking a 30,000-foot overview, and here's an outline of where we'll be going. We're going to have some background, then we're going to talk about some philosophies, some new religions, a case study, and then application. So here's where we're going to start. Here we have Aristotle, who's a student of Plato. Aristotle is the younger man on the right. Plato never wrote, and Aristotle is the one who wrote his thoughts down. He was a Greek philosopher who lived about 350 years before Christ. He is considered a father of Western philosophy. Our takeaway from Aristotle is that he reasoned humans must have a specific function suitable only for humans, and that this function must be an activity of the soul. Aristotle identified such an optimum activity of the soul as well-being. To have the potential of well-being requires individuals to have good character, morals, and ethical virtue. And by the way, I learned an awful lot while I was studying this, and I'll be sharing some of those oh by the ways. So my oh by the way about Aristotle is shortly after Plato, his teacher, died, Aristotle left Athens and became the personal tutor of Alexander the Great. So for your homeschool families, imagine having Aristotle as your teacher. About 200 years later, Marcus Cicero became a Roman politician and lawyer. Cicero is considered one of Rome's greatest orators and writers because hundreds of his letters have survived. So here are the key takeaways from Cicero. Cicero insisted on the primacy of moral standards, that is, living right and doing the right thing, over government laws. Above all, Cicero declared government is morally obliged to protect human life and private property. When government runs amok, people have a right to rebel. Cicero prosecuted crooked politicians and defended citizens against power-hungry officials. For example, he opposed Julius Caesar and Caesar's schemes for one-man rule. It stated on one occasion, as Cicero spoke, Julius Caesar reportedly trembled so much that he dropped his papers. Cicero also displayed the courage of his convictions. After Caesar's assassination, he denounced Mark Antony's bid to become dictator, and for that, Cicero was beheaded. The peak of Cicero's authority and prestige came, as we will see in a few minutes, on leading 18th century Enlightenment thinkers and political theorists, including John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. And by the way, Cicero, following the invention of Gutenberg's printing press, one of Cicero's books was the second book printed in Europe after the Gutenberg Bible. Paul the Apostle is next. Here is Caravaggio's painting, Encounter with Christ on the Road to Damascus. While Paul has many things to teach us about Christ and faith, for our purpose today, Paul's words echo the moral law stated by Cicero. That is, a law written on men's hearts, recognized by men's reason, a law that's different and distinct from written laws of any state or government, or for that matter, even scripture. For example, Paul writes in Romans 2:14 and 15, "Indeed, Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law. They show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts sometimes accusing them, and at other times defending them." Another example of Paul's that Dr. Bob used just a few weeks ago can be found in 2 Timothy 1:3. "For I thank God, whom I serve with a clear conscience," that is, acting in conformity with one's firmly held beliefs. And there are a number of other verses on the handout with similar connotations. And starting with the apostles and their followers, we can find many examples of Christians living true to their sincerely held convictions. For example, Polycarp and those that are chronicled in Fox's Book of Martyrs. So here is Augustine, who was a Christian theologian, philosopher, and bishop of Hippo in North Africa. Among his most important works are The City of God and Confessions. Augustine believed God promulgates at least some moral precepts via an instilled law which is written on the human heart or conscience. By the way, many Calvinists and Lutherans consider him to be one of the theological followers of the Protestant Reformation due to his teachings on salvation, and just as Dr. Bob mentioned this morning, on divine grace. And did you know that Augustine is the patron saint of brewers, printers, theologians, the alleviation of sore eyes, and a number of cities, including Superior, Wisconsin, Tucson, Arizona, and Kalamazoo, Michigan. See what you learned today? The Italian Dominican friar and Catholic priest Thomas Aquinas is our next stop. He lived and worked in the 13th century and is the foremost proponent of what has come to be known as natural theology. Aquinas distinguished different kinds of laws, the first two being eternal law and the second natural law. He said eternal law is the decree of God that governs all creation. It is the supreme reason and it's unchangeable and it is eternal. Natural law, the second law, is the human participation in God's eternal law. This law asserts that certain rights, and this is important, are inherent by virtue of being given by God and can be understood universally by human reason. Not surprisingly, the first principle of this law is that good is to be done and promoted and evil is to be avoided. Natural law was held to be one of the ways that God governs natural creatures like ourselves. For example, Aquinas contended that the Ten Commandments represented natural law just in its written form. By the way, Thomas embraced several ideas put forward by Aristotle, our first stop, whom he called the philosopher. And what Thomas Aquinas tried to do was to synthesize Aristotle's work with Christianity. That's kind of a big takeaway for those that are looking at Aquinas. Martin Luther was an Augustinian monk, a German professor of theology, a composer, we sang one of his hymns this morning, priest, and of course a primary figure in the Protestant Reformation. Freedom of conscience played a huge factor in his activities. In a nutshell, Luther came to reject several teachings and practices of the Catholic Church regarding indulgences. And in 1517, he just proposed an academic discussion in his 95 theses. However, the Church and the Holy Roman Empire didn't want to discuss the matter. And when pushed, Luther spoke these famous words, "Here I stand, I can do no other, may God help me." This is a classic example of articulating personal conscience in a hostile public forum. His refusal to renounce all his writings at the demand of Pope Leo X in 1520 and the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V at the Diet of Worms in 1521 resulted in his excommunication by the Church and his condemnation as an outlaw by the Emperor. And by the way, did you know that Martin Luther was actually a kidnap victim? And this is one of the latest biographies of Martin Luther. It's very easy to read, and it talks about the story of his kidnapping in here. So, so let's flash ahead 200 years to John Locke. Locke was an English philosopher and a physician. Locke combined the natural law of Aquinas with biblical revelation, since he reasoned both had originated in God and could therefore not contradict each other. He insisted that most men could not hope to understand the detailed requirements of the law of nature without the assistance of the teachings and examples of Jesus. Locke's concept of man started with creation. He wrote, "We have been sent into this world by God's order and about his business. We are his property, whose workmanship we are, made to last during his and not one another's pleasure." Locke derived the fundamental concepts of his political theory from biblical texts. So, number one, to Locke, one of the consequences of the Imago Dei, or being made in God's image, was that human beings were created equally free, and therefore governments needed the consent of the governed. Secondly, Locke reasoned that certain rights originate in God, calling them inalienable. They cannot be taken away. They cannot be granted by government, because that implies rights are legally revocable and just privileges granted by governments. Locke developed the concept of toleration based on the reaction to the European wars of religion. These wars were waged in Europe from 1522 to the mid-1600s, following the Protestant Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. Most of these conflicts ended with the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, which recognized three separate Christian traditions: Roman Catholicism, Lutheranism, and Calvinism, otherwise known as the Reformed tradition. So Locke concluded religious tolerance was important in society because earthly judges and the state in particular, and human beings in general, cannot dependably evaluate the truth claims of competing religious standpoints. And even if they could, enforcing a single true religion would not have the desired effect, because true belief cannot be compelled by violence. Locke died in 1704, but it's easy to see the effect of his writings on our founders. And by the way, although Locke was an advocate of tolerance, he urged the authorities not to tolerate atheism because he thought the denial of God's existence would undermine the social order and lead to chaos. Now, let's look at the colonial America, in particular the colonial churches. Throughout this period, most colonies had established churches, churches legally recognized as the official church. And of course, along with official recognition came special privileges like financial support from public taxation. In New England, most colonists were initially Puritans, but Congregationalism, a descendant of Puritanism, became the official church in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New Hampshire. The middle colonists had a mixture of religions, including Quakers led by William Penn, Roman Catholics, Lutherans, and Jews. Delaware was settled by Scandinavian Lutherans and later Dutch Reformed and Welsh Baptists. Throughout the South, Anglicanism was the established faith in most colonies, including Virginia, South Carolina, and Georgia. In 1636, Roger Williams was expelled by the Puritan leaders from the Massachusetts Bay Colony for spreading, quote, new and dangerous ideas. And he began settling what came to be Rhode Island as a refuge, offering what he called liberty of conscience. In Providence Plantation, he combined a democratic constitution with religious freedom. And his writings were widely read in England and Massachusetts as a plea for absolute religious freedom and the separation of church and state. And by the way, while he was originally a Puritan minister, did you know he ultimately became a Reformed Baptist minister? All in this room undoubtedly have heard of George Whitefield. Whitefield was an English Anglican cleric who graduated from Oxford, where he met the Wesley brothers. Whitfield became an itinerant preacher and evangelist. In 1740, at the age of 26, Whitfield traveled to North America, where he preached a series of revivals that became known as the Great Awakening. The importance to our review today is that the Great Awakening changed religious perspective in the colonies. Whereas before the state controlled faith, the new Christian converts and revivalists questioned and resisted state-supported religion. They saw state-endorsed religion as an obstacle to true faith. Whitfield preached at least 18,000 times to perhaps 10 million people in both Great Britain and in the American colonies. And by the way, did you know that he was cross-eyed? Funny what you learn. So now we come to a fellow who is a pain, or a thorn in the side to many. Thomas Paine was an English-born American political activist, philosopher, and revolutionary. Paine migrated to the American colonies in 1774 with the help of Franklin, and virtually every Yankee read or listened to a reading of his powerful pamphlet, Common Sense, which crystallized the demand for independence from Great Britain. Common Sense was so influential that John Adams said, without the pen of Thomas Paine, the sword of Washington would have been raised truly in vain. Paine is included this morning because he is the first writer to use the term human rights in his book, The Rights of Men. His ideas reflected the concept of a transnational human right, rights that belong to every person in the world. By the way, one historian has described him as a corset maker by trade, a journalist by profession, and a propagandist by inclination. Paine became notorious because of his pamphlet, The Age of Reason, in which he advocated deism and argued against institutionalized religion in general and Christianity in particular. He died in 1809, and only six people attended his funeral because he had been ostracized for his ridicule of Christianity. So we are now at the country's beginning. The founders had a huge, huge challenge: how to blend diversity with liberty and still create harmony. They knew the pitfalls of government-directed morality and crafted a limited government to address the nation's common defense and functional needs. Using John Locke's works, they carefully codified those inalienable rights and responsibilities of individuals to freely exercise their faith. We see in the Declaration of Independence Locke's insight that human rights are based on the biblical belief in creation, for it reads, "All men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness." Locke's doctrine in governments, that governments need the consent of the governed, is also obviously central to the Declaration of Independence. After the successful revolution, a constitution was written and finally ratified in 1787. Nevertheless, there were bitter disputes during the ratification process. Some believed that the constitution created a presidency so powerful that it would become a monarchy. The constitution, by others, did too little in regard to the courts and would create an out-of-control judiciary. And third, the national government would be too far away from the people and thus unresponsive to the needs of localities. Therefore, the Bill of Rights was crafted to address these objections, with the First Amendment reading, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances." Slowly but surely, the concept of liberty of conscience was cemented into the national thinking. An example of this was an exchange between George Washington and a man named Moses Sextus. In August 1790, President Washington visited Rhode Island. Washington stopped at the Touro Synagogue in Newport, where he was presented a letter from Moses Sextus, the warden of the Hebrew congregation. Sexus letter stated, the American public was, quote, a government which to bigotry gives no sanction, to persecution no assistance, but generously affording to all liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship, deeming everyone of whatever nation, tongue, or language equal parts of the great governmental machine. The next day, Washington responded with a letter saying, the United States citizens had a right to applaud themselves for setting an example of an enlarged and liberal policy and enshrined the freedom of conscience. He added that the ability of members of one faith to seek the benefit of all Americans is the foundation of American civic strength. The letter concluded, may the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of all the other inhabitants. And by the way, Washington's reply made it very clear that before that time, tolerance was the policy, that this had been replaced by true liberty. For example, even in the most liberal European countries at that time, for example, the Netherlands, they only tolerated non-Protestants in the Netherlands. It wasn't a freedom, an environment of freedom where everyone could express their faith openly. So religious pluralism was taking root in the American soil, and this was due to the founders' understanding that the surest protection against a repressive establishment of any one religion or ideology was to have a multiplicity of religions, allowing each religion to flourish or die on its own. Oz Guinness talks about it in this book, The Global Public Square, and I recommend it to you if you are inclined to follow up on this. In it, he said, Oz Guinness calls soul freedom, and we need to make, to be clear on what pluralism means. So Oz Guinness talks about soul freedom, or freedom of conscience, as a right for one person or group, is a right for another, and is a responsibility for both. So in other words, if I get to speak my mind, you have the right to do so also. He also says it must also be understood that freedom of thought, conscience, religion, and belief protects the believers and not the beliefs. And this is a distinction that is very vital. This means the person is protected, but his or her ideas are not protected. As Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said, the best test of truth is the power of the thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market. So let's jump ahead 150 years. And this is where we come back to that display about Tommaso Crudele in Poppy, Italy. Because what I saw there was something that I'd never really paid attention to in the past. As we all know, World Wars I and II were devastating to the Western world. And as a result of that, in the Poppy Castle, I learned that in 1948, the United Nations adopted for the first time a global expression of what many people believe to be the rights to which all human beings are inherently entitled. Quite frankly, I don't pay too much attention to what the United Nations does now. However, I think the declaration they adopted in 1948 is to be applauded. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights consists of 30 articles, which, although not legally binding, have been included in subsequent international treaties and other texts. Article 18 is of particular importance to our talk today, and it reads, everyone, and remember this is globally, everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change his religion or belief, and freedom either in community or with others, and in public or in private, to manifest his religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. By the way, of the 58 members of the United Nations at the time, 48 voted in favor of this, no one was against it, and 8 abstained, and those include included the Eastern European countries under the Soviet Union influence and Saudi Arabia. Again, let's remember John Locke's commentary on the difference between an inalienable, now called a human right, versus a civil right. The United Nations here codifies our human right of free religious expression. Remember also that civil rights are granted by governments. A human right should never be overruled by a civil right, for a civil right is only granted or withdrawn by a civil authority or government. And here's something to start thinking about. If freedom of conscience and religious liberty are inalienable and a human right, what does it mean if a civil government is able to take that human or inalienable right away? So I think we are all familiar with how the Enlightenment, that period of the 1600s, 1700s, changed the understanding of truth and how religious thought was slowly separated from facts. I won't go into all the details, but suffice to say, before the Enlightenment, relationship to all truth was generally held to be a function of or a work of God. For example, most people accepted God made the planets move as directed, gravitation was a product of God's will, etc. After the Enlightenment, a profound shift occurred throughout society. Over time, truth became what was able to be scientifically explained or proven. The spiritual realm, including faith, was left to be unprovable. Then, in the 20th century, postmodernism took hold. We all are familiar with this caustic philosophy in which many, if not most people, now believe that absolute truth no longer exists. It just depends on your experience or perspective of something. By the way, attorneys make a marvelous living playing both sides of this. How many sides does truth have, anyway? So Francis Schaeffer has helpfully put this into practical perspective by describing how people think nowadays in terms of a house or a two-story building. In the lower story are science and reason, which are considered public truth and binding on everyone. Over it is an upper story of non-cognitive experience, which is the center of personal meaning. This is the realm of private thought, where we hear people say, well, that may be true for you, but it's not true for me. So here's a chart showing the upper and lower stories of thought and truth, pretty much accepted by most people today, including many Christians. We can see the lower story contains facts that are binding on everyone and rational, verifiable matters. In the upper story are individual values, choices, and non-cognitive matters, like faith. This is frequently called the fact-value split. In society, religion is no longer considered an objective truth to which we submit, but only a matter of personal taste, which we choose, and it's a private affair. This is the single most potent weapon for delegitimizing the biblical perspective in the public square today, for it traps Christianity in that upper story of privatized values and prevents it from having any effect on public culture. As Philip Johnson has put it, science does not rule out religious belief so long as it doesn't pretend to be knowledge. As Jim mentioned over the past two Sundays, many young people do not know about the Great Commission. This really should not be a surprise, for if faith is culturally accepted as a private matter in the upper story, the whole notion of evangelizing and the Great Commission becomes nonsensical. Sadly, many American churches are not concerned with making evangelists, just new believers. We fail when new believers are not discipled to understand the full Christian message and its responsibilities. Interestingly, postmodernism has become well known and almost passé over the past 20 years. Now, however, we see a new and different philosophy at play in our society. It's called American Pragmatism, and it's moved way beyond postmodernism. You probably know it by some descriptive phrases, such as the ends justify the means or winning at any cost. This is the language of no compromise, winner take all. It is the convergence between Western illiberalism and non-Western authoritarianism. Examples abound when you know what to look for. American Litigious Society, for example, does swearing on a Bible in court mean anything anymore? Public character assassination, paying for silence, identity politics, next quarter's business earnings in the business world, shootings to get my way, whatever that is, manipulating words and laws. Simply put, I'll do anything to get what I want. So many think the culture war is now between Christianity and atheists. Still others, interestingly, assume atheism, secularism, or humanism is somehow neutral in the battle of worldviews. This is hardly the case. This is Chuck Colson, who most in this room will know as the founder of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview and Prison Fellowship. As Chuck pointed out, a worldview or religion answers four basic questions. Where did I come from? What's wrong with the world? Is there a solution? And given the first three answers, what is my purpose? Now, this is important. When a person can answer these four questions and accepts whatever that perspective is as all there is, or as an explanation of everything that they can think of, then it becomes a faith claim. It becomes a religion or a worldview. For example, atheists have answers for this grid. Where did I come from? Evolution. What's wrong with the world? Well, my genes are screwed up, or I was raised improperly, or I went to the wrong school. What is my solution? Utopian efforts, let's pass laws. And number four, what is my purpose? Self-fulfillment. But I think many have misunderstood the culture war. I don't think it's an atheist-Christian confrontation. For the past 50 years, the culture war, I believe, has been between the sexual revolution and Christianity. The sexual revolution questions everything about traditional morality and identity and demands changes in every aspect of traditional morality. Radical sexual autonomy, freedom from any form of moral judgment, plus government support. Examples abound. Free love, no fault divorce, abortion on demand, LGBTQ, sex education in schools, and most recently the SOGI claims, sexual orientation and gender identity, which our city council just approved a document about 3 or 4 weeks ago about that, for example. So this is not something far away. So let's see how the sexual liberty advocates would answer Colson's questions. Where did I come from? It's not really important. It doesn't matter. What's wrong? Well, my genes, my society, but Orthodox Christianity is what's wrong with this world. So, what do I do? I have to work on my personal liberties and forcing others to accept my beliefs. And my purpose is self-fulfillment, self-identification, and self as God. Now, I would remind you to consider how a person answers these questions becomes a worldview or, in fact, their religion. One of my personal heroes is the French scientist and Catholic theologian Blaise Pascal, who wrote, "Men never delight in doing evil as much as when they can do it for religious reasons." So let's take a breath and quickly review. We've covered a lot of ground here. So we had natural rights that are given by God, and they were called inalienable rights by our founders, and then subsequent to that, human rights by the United Nations. Inalienable or human rights are very different from civil rights, which are given by government. So another thing, religion is in that upper story or in the value sphere. It's not considered knowledge. Fourth, American pragmatism is a prevailing cultural philosophy. Number five, sexual freedom is a new religion that is supported by government. So let's remember what Christ said. In Matthew 10:16, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore be wise as snakes and innocent as doves, but be on your guard against men. But it continues, for they will take you to the court and flog you in their synagogues. You will be brought into the presence of governors and kings because of me. Which brings us to our case study. In 2012, Charlie Craig and Dave Mullins from Colorado made plans to be married in Massachusetts and returned to Colorado to celebrate with their family and friends. Craig and Mullins visited Masterpiece Cake Shop in Lakewood, Colorado in July 2012 to order a custom wedding cake for their return celebration. This is the Masterpiece Cake Shop. Masterpiece owner Jack Phillips declined their cake request, informing the men that he did not create wedding cakes for same-sex marriages due to his Christian religious beliefs. Although the men could purchase any other baked goods in the store, Craig and Mullins left Masterpiece and another bakery provided a cake for the men. Then Craig and Mullins filed a complaint with the Colorado Civil Rights Commission under the state's public accommodations law and the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act, which prohibits businesses open to the public from discriminating against their customers on the basis of race, religion, gender, or sexual orientation. The case went into the courts and is now a pending case before the Supreme Court. Masterpiece Cake Shop versus the Colorado Civil Rights Commission is to decide whether creative businesses can refuse certain services due to their First Amendment rights of free speech and free exercise of religion. The courts took oral arguments in December, so just a few months ago, with a decision likely to be made any day. Masterpiece Cake Shop petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court for the following questions. Number one, whether applying Colorado's law to compel Phillips, the cake maker, to create an expression that violates his sincerely held religious beliefs about marriage violates the free speech or free exercise clauses of the First Amendment. Now to this, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission and the ACLU said, well, wait a minute, we don't want to go there. They urged the Supreme Court to reject this appeal, fearing that a court decision in favor of the business would create a gaping hole in civil rights laws due to religion. I hope you can see this is where inalienable human rights crash against government laws. Secondly, Masterpiece also believed the anti-discrimination law can be used to selectively discriminate against religion. The state and the ACLU countered this as well, saying that the law was only aimed at the conduct of the business. Lower story, practical stuff you can see and touch. Not their speech, didn't mention conscience in their discussion. And in cases like a wedding cake, no reasonable observer would understand that the company's provision of a cake to a gay couple as an expression of the approval of that consumer's marriage. So, we're not going to go into the who shot who and what the judges are going to do. You can do that on your own. But I think, what does all this mean that we've talked about this morning, and what do we do with it? So, obviously, it'll be interesting to learn how the Supreme Court handles the case. Regardless of the outcome, there are many lessons for Christ followers. Number one, what if Masterpiece prevails? They win. This will be cause for thankfulness. However, there is no reason to think the ongoing cultural bias against Orthodox Christianity will soon go away. There will certainly be other challenges in different venues and circumstances, and we need to remember that the Lord is in charge of all that transpires. So what if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission? Well, First, we need to remember there is a cost to being a Christian. Cultural rejection is a scriptural promise and a long-time historical fact. If anyone in this congregation thinks that the culture is just hunky-dory with Christ's message, I suggest you take a cold shower and wake up. Christianity is not for wimps. Persecution in this life is promised. And I submit a couple of verses. Christ told us in John 15:18, if the world hates you, you all know this, keep in mind it hated me first. And Paul promises in 2 Timothy 3:12, in fact, everyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. So there'll be more challenges to force Christians into secluded private worship in that upper story instead of openly speaking in the public square and acting in accordance with our conscience. The movement to keep our upper story thoughts to ourselves may one day become law, as our inalienable rights are trampled by civil rights. We need to understand the magnitude of this effort and the potential for a fundamental shift in the American way of life. Recall, inalienable rights, those given by God, cannot be taken away, but civil authorities can force people to do things against those consciences or face consequences. We also need to realize that the rot that threatens to destroy this generation will not be stopped by editorials, apologetics, or Lord forbid, politics. Don't trust the government ever. Only the Lord's grace can keep this generation from its own demise. That grace comes to and through us, the people of grace. Again, part of that grace is recalling that we are blessed when we are unjustly treated on account of the truth, and then responding as if we truly believe that we are being blessed. Well, none of us, hopefully, will end up before the Supreme Court. Each of us will from time to time run into ungodly circumstances. As such, we need to regularly pray for grace and confidence under pressure from ungodly forces, hostility and rejection. Joel Belts, the editor of World Magazine, says, pray that God's people learn to welcome the loss of our own freedoms, if such a loss can enhance the proclamation of the good news of salvation in Christ. In the next few weeks, we'll learn how the Supreme Court rules. Regardless, please keep the ruling in perspective of eternal matters and not simply U.S. politics. There are a couple of other observations and applications for us as well. These include that we need to pray. And I would suggest we regularly pray that the Lord corrupts those forces against ungodly worldviews. It may seem odd to ask the Lord to corrupt something, but I think you will find this squarely hits Satan's minions. Another sobering realization is, as Oz Guinness says in this book, The Global Public Square, that Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 18 included, would not and could not be passed today. Think about what that means about our world. We all should be human rights supporters and advocates for every human's inalienable rights. We all, and this church, should support groups defending religious liberty, for example, the Alliance Defending Freedom, Beckett's Fund, and the Christian Legal Society. Remember, religious liberty is not partisan. It applies to all faiths. Some seem inclined to deny religious liberty to Muslims, but the same legal standard must apply to all faiths because it is a human right. Then, let the marketplace of ideas determine the best outcome. Again, Joel Belts has some pointed words for us. Pray that when any showdown comes, we as God's people might more typically be found speaking for and defending the rights of others than our own privileges and prerogatives. And finally, I wish to specifically address those young people that are looking for a life's purpose. And I'm really sincere about this. And fortunately, we have a lot of young people in our congregation. The first is restoring the primacy of freedom of conscience and belief for people of all faiths and none. This means restoring the ability to discuss one's religious views anywhere, but especially in public. The core of this effort is to restore a common understanding of what an inalienable right is and how these differ from rights granted by governments. You will need to educate yourself, you will need to teach others, and find yourself in Christ's service, even while working with people of other faiths or no faith at all. Bells would advise you to not be a lone ranger. The history of various causes includes a lot of well-intentioned people who would have represented their Lord and their cause more effectively if they had surrounded themselves with wise, principled, practical, and straightforwardly honest counselors. So seriously and thoughtfully take on the challenge to make God-given inalienable rights untouchable by any government. The second challenge to consider: revealing atheism and the sexual liberty movement as belief systems equivalent to other faiths. Currently, atheism is blindly accepted by most as somehow neutral in the realm of ideas. Sanitizing the public square of all religion, except, of course, atheism, is currently and blindly accepted. As we know, atheism is able to answer those four questions that Colson asked. Likewise, the sexual liberty movement has been presented and sold as a civil right and held by many with a religious fervor, and pushed as superior to other people's firmly held inalienable rights. Young people wishing to take on a serious, far-reaching effort on behalf of Christ might consider this lifelong project as part of their Christian walk. The goal is to get millions of common people to understand that atheism and sexual freedom are faith walks equivalent to Christianity. In closing, I'll quote Oz Guinness and Joel Beltz again. Guinness writes, "To the degree that a society has truly widened the spheres of freedom for all its citizens in practice, it can be judged to be truly free. But to the degree it refuses to do so, or no longer continues to do so, it does not deserve the name of freedom, regardless of what its rhetoric and regardless of its previous record." And Beltz exhorts us to, quote, "Pray that God's people, when their freedoms are threatened, will never be whiners, but people instead who glory in the privilege of giving up a gift they've never deserved in the first place. To God be the glory."